They know how to make great pizza.
Welcome back to Pizza Grit. I'm Zach Codgers, a pediatric ICU fellow from UT Southwestern in Dallas.
And I'm Alice Shanklin, a critical care fellow at Children's National in Washington, D.C.
So Alice, what are we talking about today?
Today is part three of our congenital diaphragmatic hernia episode. Here, we're talking about what you're actually doing in the surgical repair and how these kids do long-term. Zach, who are we talking with?
So we're excited to have Dr. Amir Ashrafi and Dr. Yeet Gunner back with us on the podcast. Dr. Gunner is an assistant professor of surgery at UC Irvine, and he's a pediatric surgeon at Children's Hospital of Orange County. He is nationally recognized for his work in CDH, including being the first author on the ELSO CDH guidelines.
Yes. Zach, on this rare double guideline author episode, we've got Dr. Ashrafi. He's a fully double-boarded neonatal cardiologist. He did NICU at UCLA, cardiology at Boston Children's, and now he's practicing at Children's Hospital of Orange County. Dr. Ashrafi has a specific interest, obviously, in neonates with congenital heart disease. He's also the co-founder of the NeoHeart Conference, which tackles these issues in depth.
Yes, two great expert guests for today's episode. I learned so much after meeting with them. We are very excited to share it with you. So Dr. Ashrafi, you have this kid requiring vasoactives. They're having issues with hypotension and shock. What is the role of corticosteroids in these patients?
As far as I'm aware, there is no RCTs looking at the use of steroids in babies with diaphragmatic hernia. So we're going to have to extrapolate from other studies when's the best time to use steroids for these patients. I'll be honest with you, my personal practice of steroids probably is not in line with the evidence. You read the evidence and, I mean, you read a paper, they make you think that steroids is the worst thing in the world, everything, you know, all sorts of badness can happen, including, and I don't want to poo-poo it, including abnormal long-term neurodevelopmental outcome down the road. So again, I don't want to poo-poo that, but we are relatively quick to pull the trigger on steroids at my institution. We don't necessarily commit them to a long-term course. This is not the right way, not the wrong way. It's just our way. Hydrocortisone is our steroid of choice, more so than dexamethasone. Short courses when necessary. And so how do you define necessary? If we have them on a couple of vasoactive meds and they're not doing better, one to two vasoactive meds. And if we need steroids to supplement, we'll do it at that point in time. But there's no great science on when to use steroids in CDH. It's very going to be person dependent and person to person variability and institution to institution variability.
It's very helpful. I'd like to transition now to timing of surgical repair. First, I'd like to know, in an ideal world, that being a patient that doesn't require ECMO, exactly when do you move forward with the surgical repair? And then after this, we'll transition back to the patient who does require ECMO.
That's great. Yeah, we never discuss a low-risk patient or the moderate-risk patient that behaves like a low-risk patient or moderate-risk patient who's not requiring ECMO, but there are some nuances to those decisions. But for generally a low-risk patient, I think a few days after birth, you can do the surgery that you find. The chance that you're going to make him sick and go on ECMO is extremely unlikely. Honestly, I've never seen it. I've only had one baby in the last 10 years that needed ECMO after CDH repair on the fourth day of life, but that baby was not a low-risk baby. And they did great after ECMO, honestly. After a few days, that may have been just pulmonary hypertensive crisis that just needed some additional support. That's pretty much what I have to say about the low-risk babies. There have been a number of studies looking at how many echoes you have to do or if you have to do any echoes. That's a long discussion. You just look at the preductal sats and gases, and if the baby is stable, I think after a few days, normal cardiac anatomy, you can move on to repair. That's that.
I would imagine by stable, you mean there's not a large differential between the preductal and postductal sat. Is that what you're getting at?
Sure. From a surgeon's perspective, I'm not sure if that difference is always something I look for. Because most of the babies who are sitting in the high 90s with a low of 502, I don't even think they need an echo, although my partners have challenged me on that. But most of those babies don't have much of a differential anyway.
I understand.
You might have mentioned this, but what day of life would be typical for these low-risk babies?
I don't think, honestly, it makes a difference. You know, maybe a different question is, how about the echo findings? What if there's flow across the doctor says bidirectional or right to left, but they're not requiring that much oxygen? That happens. Do you wait a few more days, get a repeat echo? We have.
Interesting.
Do you need to wait beyond a week? Probably not. I think you can just look at how much oxygen they're requiring, and that tells you a lot.
That makes plenty of sense. Transitioning maybe to the patient that's a little bit sicker. Say they had significant gas exchange deficits, they had shock, they were cannulated into VA ECMO the first 24, 48 hours of life. Now you're sitting here 2 days into your run on ECMO. What decision do you have before you now to think about repairing on ECMO, or is it your practice to wait till they're much, much better?
Well, this is, again, a lot of bias, dogma, and sometimes just how it is. But at the center that we're at, CHOC/UCI, and obviously ECMO, you know, there's a lot of history here. Dr. John German in the 70s, in 1977, wrote the first paper on the use of ECMO for CDH, where he described four patients. All four were repaired on ECMO. One of those four survived.
Oh, wow.
To my knowledge, that was 1977. I have never seen a baby repaired after ECMO at our center. It may have happened prior to me being here, but you know, we have a long history of doing this. We've always been an on ECMO repair center. I do know that at our closest other children's hospital, CHLA, they've always been an after ECMO repair center, as far as I know. CHOP may be that way, and Michigan has moved to that as well in some patients. But phenotype is important. So let me just summarize what I just said. The current discussion is whether you do early repair on ECMO for every patient, early repair within the first 48 hours, maybe 72 max. And I don't know, some define super early within even earlier, early repair, I'll explain why, versus after ECMO, post-decannulation. Those are the two right ways of doing it that I know that exist. The disadvantage of doing repair after ECMO is some patients, there's a non-repair group.
Right.
Some patients will never come to surgery and they will die.
Mm. Yes.
The advantage of the post-ECMO repair group is that you've selected the survivors.
Gotcha.
So they do better.
That's just me summarizing the data. It doesn't mean people who do this, the experts in these centers, don't know. You know, like I said, they know how to make great pizza, okay? They know how to do it right either way. So I'll give you an example. David Case, Dr. Case, you know, we can't replicate his results. His 90% survival. They have CDH units. And so they're an early repair center. And they have this down. You know, they've done this so many times. They have a team that does this. Other centers who do post-ECMO repair, they've been doing this for a while, they have it down. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a disadvantage. Some patients will die, but what's the right answer? That I don't know. We always feel like we've never met the baby we could take off ECMO to do a repair. Maybe it's just our ECMO selection criteria. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's where what I was mentioning earlier is when you go on ECMO, who goes on ECMO, how early you go on, your liberal use of ECMO. Maybe those are the things that set that apart. And our center, we're careful selecting patients who go on ECMO. And then when they do, we repair them early.
Interesting.
And obviously there's going to be some non-survivors in that.
Mm-hmm. That's fascinating. It's a great answer to a question posed as a non-surgeon who has limited insight into the decision-making about when to repair. It seems that there are significant system factors that go into this decision. So if your system is designed to repair early on ECMO, you'll probably get better outcomes if you stick with that system. On the other hand, if your system is designed to perform the repair after your ECMO run, it certainly seems like you should stick with that strategy, since we don't know which one is better for all comers.
Yes, and obviously people have lots of arguments, one versus the other. We can get into some of those, but that's a good summary.
Are there any subtleties of that discussion, that argument you mentioned, that you feel like we should appreciate? Risk and benefits versus repairing early versus late?
Well, what I could say is when you're done with your training, you're going to go at center A versus center B, wherever you are. Hopefully they have a uniform practice. You may be stuck in a position after being there 10 years to want to change that practice. And that's not easy. I don't know if that's the answer you were looking for, but maybe that's where we are now. I'm looking at Amir, we're looking at each other. Is it time to change our practice?
It does sound like the important thing for new faculty is to show up as the neonatal cardiologist or the neonatologist and not say, hey, why don't you take this kid down now if that's not what's done?
Yeah.
That does kind of remind me of when I first talked to Cleary. It was at an ECMO conference. We have a Friday ECMO conference once a month. And we had a meconium baby or a CDH baby who was on the oscillator, I think on ECMO. And I had such an issue with that. And then I had just come there from Houston. I was a major ECMO center, mm-hmm. trained with Dr. Lally and the group. And I started arguing with him, and I caught myself arguing with this guy who's kind of famous. Then after the meeting, I was like, who is this guy? He knows what he's talking about.
Who does he think he is?
And then I don't know if I got his respect or not, but it went well after that. He didn't turn on me.
Interesting.
But I don't know what the right answer for new faculty is. Maybe the senior faculty likes seeing passion, if it's respectful, hopefully.
Certainly.
I don't know. Amir, what do you think about that?
Oh, I completely agree.
Yeah, be passionate about what you believe in, but also respectful for those that come before you.
Can I make one comment on surgery on ECMO real quick?
Certainly.
Whenever these kids are on ECMO, we're always so fearful of bleeding, appropriately so. If a kid has an umbilical line, oh my God, don't touch those umbilical lines. They'll bleed to death. Mm-hmm. Only put in an additional PICC line or ART line if you absolutely have to. They're going to bleed to death. I've been impressed with how many CDH repairs we've done on ECMO and have had no bleeding issues whatsoever. Zero. None. We were joking around. One of the first conversations that Dr. Gunner and I had after orientation is we got into a big fight over Amicar because we were so freaked out about bleeding on repairing on ECMO. And again, I don't remember why. There was some nuance to this patient that we were really freaked out about bleeding. But they just, we've never had an issue bleeding. Why do you think that is?
Well, that probably was the first time I was going to do one of these since fellowship. And I probably felt a lot of pressure to replicate what I'd learned in fellowship. And I got the protocol from Houston. And I didn't want to call Houston, we have a problem. And so Amir is like, well, our hematologists, they're a little bit in disagreement that Amicar is needed. And we've had complications in the past with the use of Amicar, circuit clotting and whatnot, and thrashes the circuit. So I was very nervous about not being able to replicate exactly what I'd done in fellowship. Then we didn't use it.
I thought we did use it.
I guess you don't need it.
No, I thought we did use it.
We had it available.
Are you sure? Okay.
We had it drawn and available. Of course, people discuss if you don't give it pre-surgery, or TXA is another example, you know, trifibrinolytic effects. I don't know if I pronounced that correctly, but it doesn't work well after if you use it after. That's an argument for having it available and using it if you have bleeding. But no, we don't use it. We haven't used it that I can recall. If I forgot, I apologize. But to answer your question, what Dr. Lally had taught me is the way you do the repair is a minimal mobilization of the posterior rim. And, you know, just put a patch in. You could think of it as simply as a damage control repair. Of course, it's not that. It's not the same. But you don't spend too much time doing a perfect surgery, muscle to muscle. Just put a patch in and get out. And, okay, you could have a recurrence, and maybe at some point down the road with that approach. But that's not life-threatening, in my opinion. So just liberal use of patch, minimal mobilization, use of other products like Sorbicel, et cetera. A little packing, leaving the abdomen open can also be done as needed. I suppose if we, you know, get to a huge number of repairs, one will bleed, but maybe also we haven't had a huge number. Some of those big centers might. So you don't want to have bad luck. Now they're saying we haven't had bleeding.
Yeah, that's right.
Wow.
And is there any consensus, or maybe consensus isn't the right word, do you feel like the surgical field is moving towards open versus thoracoscopic repair of these kids?
You know, it's not really possible to do a thoracoscopic repair in the NICU when babies are often extremely sick on the oscillator. You don't want to move them to the operating room. In our hospital, they're on two separate floors, even if they were on the same floor, minimizing ventilator changes. So if you just think of a baby on a conventional ventilator, let's just say relatively stable, to go to the OR from the NICU, you have a NICU ventilator. You have to go on the transport ventilator, which is, you know, like a moving crib, little box thing, whatever it's called. And then they get to the OR, they go to the OR ventilator, surgery is done, they go back onto the mobile ventilator, then they go back to the NICU, to the NICU ventilator. Most babies tolerate that fine, but we don't want to do that to many babies, so they end up surgeries done at the bedside, and it's not possible to do that at the bedside. I suppose we could take the oscillator to the OR, but I'm not sure that it's worthwhile to do that. So those babies would get an open repair. Or if you can wean them to a conventional ventilator, yeah, you could do that. So that's my answer to the thoracoscopy. If we can do thoracoscopic repair, we do it. And then the question is, do you use a patch or not, or do you do a primary repair? Some would just go ahead and do an open repair if you need a patch, and recurrence rates are a little bit higher with the patch.
Yes, that makes sense. If we're the fellow in the intensive care unit taking care of one of these patients after surgery, what are those important or common postoperative complications that we should be aware of? We've even mentioned bleeding already, but what else?
Well, abdominal compartment syndrome, that's probably the most important one. And so that happens because it's similar to a gastroschisis where the bowel is outside the body, but in this case, it's inside the chest. And sometimes stuffing that back all down below the diaphragm can lead to a very swollen abdomen. And the bowel kind of swells up sometimes during surgery and whatnot. So that's rare to have that because most surgeons would recognize it's a difficult closure and would do a temporary closure, come back a few days later and do a formal closure. Bleeding, compartment syndrome, pulmonary hypertensive crisis as a perioperative stress. Other complications, obviously, are you could have airway complications. You could lose the ET tube. You'd be careful. You could have ECMO complications, you know, circuit complications, hemolysis, blood transfusion, all that stuff can lead to hemolysis. Or you could just have an old circuit and you give Amicar or other blood products during surgery, or you lower your anticoagulation, leads to hemolysis and circuit complications. So it's challenging.
I've read that if these patients require a chest tube, and if you were to put that chest tube on suction, you could potentially cause tension physiology. Is that something that you feel like is clinically relevant? Is that something that you think about or talk about much?
You know, we often do not use a chest tube for a normal repair for a patient who's not on ECMO. And I've never seen that happen, but we empty the chest in the OR prior to closing, usually with a red rubber tube or some other means. But I've never seen it physiologically be a problem. When we have a complex patient on ECMO, some people may not want to leave a chest tube because of the patch. Often I do leave a chest tube, and I've never had it be a problem.
Fair enough.
Can you teach me? I'm not even sure I understand. How would it lead to a tension physiology?
So what I read is that you have a very hypoplastic, say, left lung, and then you put this chest tube under suction, and maybe the, you know, the 20 or standard 20 or 40 of suction that we would typically use maybe is enough to cause the mediastinum to shift to the left and perhaps impair hemodynamics.
Oh, interesting.
But it seems like that's not something clinically relevant you guys are dealing with.
We're glad that that's not
I've
happening.
I've never seen that.
Yeah,
I've never seen it, but I guess.
I will say this is like so deeply obvious for you guys, but if your kid has had a CVH repair, anything funny about the anatomy, and you later in life, they're presenting with a pleural effusion, you're going to want to really image that pleural effusion before you poke it. That's a lifelong thing for them.
Something tells me the intern's not placing that chest tubes, what I'm hearing.
Yeah, yeah.
What type of outcomes should our parents expect at high volume CDH centers?
So that's some of my new research. Much of my research used to be sort of looking at intervention-based outcomes. So if you do VA versus VV, or if you use this versus that. And I've started to look at hospital-based outcomes for diaphragmatic hernia. One recent paper we looked at was standardizing mortality ratios for different centers and looking at if there are there differences if you just compare apples to apples at different centers. And there are high performers and there are low performers, but most are average performers with no difference. I'm not sure where our center falls because the data are de-identified to me as far as what center is. Another paper we just submitted that's looking at volume outcome for ECMO and CDH, and clearly there's a difference. The centers that are high-volume centers are having better outcomes. Again, that's risk-adjusted, so it's not just because you're putting everybody that comes on ECMO, even their higher, low, medium risk. Mm-hmm. So there's that. The more you do, the better you get at it. That is absolutely true. And it's not just that. There's also differences so between the high performers and low performers, what they do. That's sort of where I came onto this idea about, like, you know, using nitric versus not, you know, using conventional ventilator than going on ECMO. Those centers who have better outcomes are clearly doing some things differently. Mm-hmm. There's a difference in treatment, pre-ECMO treatment. Same for volume. Centers with poorer outcomes have more complications. That's sort of like a PowerPoint presentation answer to your question. But what I would tell the parents, that's, you know, I'd be honest at your own center as much as possible. Everyone wants these patients. But if you can track your own numbers and you could show them, I guess that would be one version of honesty. Mm-hmm. And if you're participating, for example, in the congenital diaphragmatic hernia study group, they provide that report for you.
Oh, nice.
You know, my good friends, Dr. Harding, does a great job. So you could do something like that to give great evidence to your own patients.
What are some of the long-term comorbidities that these patients face?
So it's important to have a long-term follow-up clinic. We have something called the EDAC clinic. What does EDAC stand for, Amir?
Early Developmental Assessment Clinic.
There's multiple team members that look at the different components, different ages. But obviously, we want to make sure that they have good neurodevelopmental outcomes. And if they're falling behind, to get them resources early so that they're not, you know, in fourth grade and they're being told to repeat fourth grade, et cetera, or other resources they may need, like physical therapy, speech therapy, feeding therapy, et cetera.
I can't say for sure what's in the future other than just what I read in textbooks and in papers. But what I can say that we do, I think, a pretty good job of is, in addition to outpatient follow-up with PEDS surgery, with cardiology, with pulmonology as necessary, as Dr. Gunner talked about, we do have this EDAC clinic, Early Developmental Assessment Clinic, the idea being that up to 3 years of age, the newborn brain is quite has a lot of plasticity, and we want to capitalize on that. So any injury that can take place, these guys follow up approximately every 3 to 6 months and do a graduated neurodevelopmental assessment. And whatever the gaps are there, we'll then try to give different therapies to try to get these kids to catch up. The other thing that we have is something called a bridge clinic. Oftentimes this can be quite overwhelming for general pediatricians if it is one of these complex kids who's got multiple issues. And so the bridge clinic, it really, it's just that it's a bridge between the inpatient world and the outpatient world. So there's really quite a, just a lot of hand holding for the outpatient pediatrician to make sure that this nothing falls through the cracks. And so the bridge lasts for about 6 months. EDAC lasts for about 3 years. And we do everything we can to try to give these kids the best possible long-term outcomes. Once upon a time, that success was defined as survival to discharge. But 2023, that's no longer a goal. That's an expectation. These kids are supposed to go home. The way we define success is, you know, when they're 5, are they going to normal schools? When they're 12, are they playing sports? When they're 18, are they going to the best colleges? And that's really what all of these different developmental clinics are intending to do.
Yes, and that's what our families want for their children. So it certainly seems to be the outcome we should shoot for. It's more of a fun question. So let's say you run the world. You own all the grant dollars. You can set the agenda for CDH-related research. What are the questions that you want answered in your respective field?
You know, one of my earlier research projects was developing a CDH risk score for ECMO. Mm-hmm. It's at chalk.org/ECMOcalc, and it gives you a risk prediction for ECMO survival for diaphragmatic hernia based on ELSA data.
Wow.
And so that's a resource, and there's other resources on the ELSA website. Those are just the past now, if you think of what we can do with machine learning. So that's where my mind is at. It really is. I think that's what I'd like to work on, make some contribution there.
Sure. What a fascinating response. And it sounds like we have another topic suggestion for the podcast as well that we'll have to revisit. Anything for you, Dr. Ashrafi?
Nothing came to mind, but the idea of AI in managing these patients, that's mind expanding. I like that. We definitely need to look into that, Gunnar.
Yeah. I mean, if you could just feed the echo data real time to, train a GPT model to read echo data, you know, I mean, how fascinating would that be? I'm sure it'll happen in the future. But I do have a question for you guys, Zach
sure.
and Alice. You guys asked us outside of medicine what we do. So I have what do you guys do?
That's so great. Alice, go for it.
Now, in COVID, this was tough, but I love going to concerts in Washington, D.C. I just got tickets to see Maggie Rogers. I'm so excited.
So fun.
Who's Maggie Rogers?
She's a pop rock artist, I would say.
Yeah, very fun. And it's so great being asked questions on our own podcast. We've actually never share anything about our...
You really turned the
table. We never share anything about ourselves.
We don't.
There are 3 little ones at my house, along with me and my wife. So 5, 3, and 1. So we have a very rambunctious household. So from the moment that I come home from work till about 8 p.m., it is 100 miles an hour, just trying to keep kids alive and thriving. And usually we find ourselves playing outside. I have a little bike trailer that I put 2 of the kids in, and the oldest is better about riding his tricycle. And we have a good time. And usually the days end in tears, whether they're happy tears or sad tears for the littlest of the 3. So it's so fun. There's never a dull moment.
That's awesome.
Well, would you like one final question?
For sure.
I do like listening to podcasts. And one of my favorite podcasts, a guy called Ted King, he's a cyclist. Mm-hmm. And at the end of his podcast, he always asks the same question to every person he's interviewing. But he says, if you could bike anywhere, where would you bike? And who would you bike with? And what bike you would use? So can you do the critical care version of that? If you could take care of any disease, what disease it would be, where would you, which hospital you would do it, or some similar comparison?
Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness.
I guess in our case, it would be diaphragmatic hernia at CHOP. We're together.
You're already doing it.
I don't know
it.
If he has the same answer.
I'd want to take care of septic shock on VA ECMO at whatever institution will hire me. How about that?
That's great.
I would like to manage a post-arrest patient with Dr. Topshin at CHOP.
Heyo, good choice. In a teaser for our episode,
great.
For sure. Well, gentlemen, this has been a pleasure. I mean, you guys sharing your information with us. I feel like we were in the CHOC NICU or surgery department. You guys were talking back and forth about your favorite disease. And we benefited so much from listening to this. And I know that our listeners will as well. Anything to leave with our listeners as we wrap things up? This can be a highlight of a key point or anything else you'd like to plug.
Sure, I can put in a plug-in for the World Congress of Pediatric Cardiology and Cardiothoracic Surgery. multiple tracks within the World Congress, one of which is a conference that we host called NeoHeart, all focused on cardiovascular management of the neonate, sessions dedicated to the hemodynamics of septic shock, hemodynamics of congenital diaphragmatic hernia, you know, a whole bunch of different things. But if you're interested, we'd love to see you.
Fantastic. Well, thank you both. Your friendship and teaching is aspirational, and we really appreciate you guys coming on the pod.
Awesome. Thank you guys so much.
And thank you for listening to this episode of Pete's Crit. Please remember that all content during this episode is intended for informational and educational purposes only. It should not be used as a replacement for medical advice. It's also worth noting that the views expressed during this episode by me, Zach, and our guests are our own and do not reflect the official position of our institutions. If you have any comments, suggestions, or feedback, you can email us at pedscritpodcast@gmail.com. If you want to help support the production of Pete's Crit, you can find us on Venmo and Patreon. We've also had some light merch made in the form of Pete's Crit laptop stickers. And if you include a mailing address with any contribution, we would be so excited to send you one. Thank you again for listening. All right, Zach, actually, you know the secret to making good pizza.
Well, you know, I would hate to share any good secret over the air with thousands of people, but tell me, what is the secret of making good pizza?
It's the New York water.
I thought that was bagels, actually.
That's why you can't get it elsewhere.
So you're saying you can't tell me how to make good pizza. I got to have the New York water.
Unfortunately, this is the secret.